Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on May 27th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Good evening. I'm Bruce Goldstein of Film Forum. And before we introduce our guest, I want you to see a clip from a movie we showed just a few weeks ago, because a scene in it struck me that relates to this movie. This is from our Noel Coward Festival 2 weeks ago. Let's take a look. Our guest could have been the baby in that pram because he chose to be born at exactly that time in that place or in that part of the world. Please welcome the co-star of The Fallen Idol, a mere 68 years later, Robert Henry.
Yeah.
You know, we've known each other 10 years now. A guy called me from Greenwich Hospital saying the kid from Fallen Idol works is at Greenwich Hospital. We'll talk about that later.
Right.
I said, you're crazy. He's in France or England. But you've been living in Connecticut for the last, what?
35 years.
35 years. But you notice he wears his hair the same way? Well, your story before The Fallen Idol is almost as good as the movie. You were born in France 3 months before the war started, correct? You could tell the story too, you know. Your mother...
But you tell it.
But I've read I've read three books about you, actually.
He's done the research.
Well, your mother was French and your father was English.
Yeah, exactly.
And tell us about your early life and why you moved out of your birthplace, would you tell them?
Yes. Well, as Bruce has said, he's done all the research. I was born just before the war, June of 1939. My mother was French, and my father had fallen in love with the idea of buying a small farm in Normandy, which he bought in 1937, and I was born in 39. And it was a miserable time to be born because, as Bruce said, 3 months later, the war was declared. But nothing very much happened for about 10 months. It was what they called the phony war. And my father was working in London. My mother remained in France. And then suddenly, Germany invaded Poland. The German army came through the French defenses, and there was sudden panic as the German army invaded Belgium and the whole of France. And so my father came right back, was able to get hold of my mother and myself, and we escaped by one of the last British ships to leave Saint-Malo, which is in Brittany, and managed to get back to England just before the arrival of the German army.
But they moved to the center of London, which was
they
not a great place either.
They moved to the center of London, and the paradox was that my father had no money because he'd invested all his money in this little place. And the cheap, you'll all love this
meaning
story.
Your farm.
The cheapest place to live in all of England, probably the whole of Europe, was Mayfair, right in the center of London, and because it was being bombed by the German Luftwaffe. So cheapest rents. And so
you lived through the Blitz.
That's where we lived, through the Blitz. And I was a little kiddie. I was I became, you know, conscious of the fact that it was kind of normal to go out and to see sort of buildings just suddenly crumble under...
But most kids were evacuated out of central London.
Most people were evacuated.
But why did your parents not send you away?
My parents had very, very strong ideas about the fact that they wanted to... I was their only child. They wanted to keep me there. They didn't want to send me to school. They wanted to keep me right there in the middle of London. And I guess that they got their own way. And so I was kind of brought up in a curious environment, didn't go to school. My mother always spoke to me in French, and so did my father, as a matter of fact, so we spoke French all the time. And no school, and basically no kids of my age to play with. So it was a kind of a curious, it was a curious way to be brought up.
I'll say.
Yeah.
And, but we said, I said he was the kid in the pram. Let's take a look at our first picture, Raymond. There you are in your pram. You're about.
This is Mayfair. This is the high rent district, or became the high rent district.
Not in those days. You're about 2 or 3 years. In the next slide, Raymond, this is what was happening around you. This is picture came out of a book your parents wrote
called
A Village in Piccadilly you living in central London during the Blitz.
Again, my parents had basically lost all their money as a result of buying this farm in France. My father was a journalist, and he started writing. He'd always wanted to write, and he starts writing books about what it's like living in London during the war. And it was kind of his way to sort of get even with life. You know, the war had taken everything away from him, and so he kind of wanted to use his pen to sort of somehow reassert himself. So he started writing.
So the war ended when you were about 6, 1945.
Well, 1944 in Europe, 1945,
in
the Pacific, yes.
So you're about 5 years old.
Yeah.
And you go back to Normandy.
We go back to Normandy. Not until, you couldn't travel in Europe for a while, not until probably the end of 45, beginning of 46.
But all those years, did you have any interest whatsoever in becoming a film actor?
Absolutely not. The only thing I knew about movies is my mother, who would get sort of bored sometimes in the afternoon. She would go to these double feature movies. You're all too young to remember this, but the old movies, you had double features. And
my mother, there
were no babysitters. I couldn't go to school. So my mother would drag me to these movies, double features, and I would sort of fiddle and fall asleep. That was my only exposure to movies.
But that was much later. So how did you get cast in The Fallen Idol?
This is the question. Let's go to what the story was about, as you've just seen the movie. The setting is in an embassy, and as you can see, the little kid in the movie talks funny. He talks fairly fluent English. I mean, that was me at the age of eight. Okay, but with an accent, strong French accent, because French was my mother tongue. It still is my mother tongue. But I talked funny, and it sort of fit well with the idea of the movie being shot in an embassy in post-war London. Now, the question, and Bruce was going to ask it, but I'll furnish the answer before he asks the question. Why was it in an embassy? This is based on a Graham Greene story. It was a short story called The Basement Room that was published in 1935. It was one of a set of short stories. The short story, the same idea to the extent that this is a big London townhouse, obviously with a big staircase, and you can see how important the staircase is to the telling of the story. You can't tell the story without the staircase. And so this is a wealthy British family, and the little kid is left with the butler over the weekend. And the story in The Basement Room has similarities. But Graham Greene and Carol Reed are sitting around in 1947 with Graham Greene having the job to turn this short story into a movie script. And they're sitting in a hotel room in Brighton working out the story, the screenplay. And one of them says, you know, this thing doesn't make sense. We want to set the film contemporaneously. In other words, 1947. There are almost no British families that can afford in 1947, when the rates of tax in Britain in 1947 are like 90, the top rate is like 97.5%. And they said it's unrealistic to assume that there would be a British family who could afford that kind of house with servants, you know, with a butler and a maid and so on. That's impossible. So they said, well, yeah, but we want to continue the contemporary setting. So they decide that they're going to change the setting to an embassy because, yeah, embassies could afford that kind of house, particularly in the center of London. And then that means, of course, that they have to find a little kid, and you can see the importance of that role because the whole story is told. I mean, that's the Graham Greene idea. The whole story is told through the eyes of the child. So they have these great actors who are very well known, Ralph Richardson, Michelle Morgan, very well known actors, but who are they going to get to do this, the role of the little kid? And somebody on the team, on the movie team, must have, well, did actually read my father's book about what it was like to live in London during the war. And there was that picture.
We have it.
Actually,
here's the picture they saw.
I'm going to show you
next one, Raymond. Picture.
Okay, and this is me, probably 1943, I would guess.
You're about 3 years old.
Maybe 42. I'm looking out of the window, and from the context of the book, they can tell that this little kid is living in London, therefore he must probably speak, some English, you know, living in London, but probably from the context can tell that he must speak funny. Because hadn't been to school, doesn't have any other friends, and is brought up with French-speaking parents. So they decide they had apparently interviewed other kids and it hadn't worked out. So they call up the publisher and they say we'd like to interview the kid. So that's how it came.
And they
about.
Flew you from Normandy for one day.
Yeah, because the war was over and I was back. The house I was born in Normandy with the chickens and so on. It was kind of a wonderful for me to live in the country. So the invitation comes through, and you know they were big movie moguls. I mean, this was,
you met with Korda, correct?
Yeah, Alexander Korda
and Carol Reed.
I mean, this was.
But you didn't know it was happening.
I didn't know anything about this. But these were, you know, these were very. They had a big budget, and so they sent a private plane to pick me up just for the day. They picked me up, and I sort of went to the lunch with my mother and my father. And so people say to me, well, was it an audition? I don't know whether an audition. They gave me lunch. I've always liked eating, so that was great, okay? Gave me lunch, and I was sort of conscious of the fact they were taking pictures, and they talked to me. And, yeah, I guess it was an audition, you know, and they sent us back, and that evening I was back in France.
And they never talked to another kid after meeting you that day.
That's
and you
right.
got the part, but
That's
you had never acted, so how did you give this amazing performance?
The legend is that I was totally useless and that it was thanks to the great talent of Carol Reed.
Next picture, please.
Who's this wonderful producer and produces this wonderful film with this kid who's completely clueless.
And here he is with you. That's Carol Reed. He was 6'3", and he mimicked everything you were going to do. Is that correct?
Well, there's a legend around this, that the kid's useless, and every step of the way I'm told exactly what to do. Carol Reed observes me. I have these mannerisms. I mean, we all have mannerisms. I have plenty of mannerisms. And he adopts them and gets me to do that which he wishes me to do within the screenplay.
There was an article in Life magazine that came out around the time of the movie. It said that, quote, you had never acted in so much as a kindergarten pantomime and had not been known to perform a tap dance, sing in tune, or even recite a poem with distinction.
That's damning with faint praise.
It also said that he would have you repeat line readings 20 to 100 times.
Well, I think there's slight exaggeration there, but there you are. You know, I was clueless.
But your longest line in the movie is 14 words. Do you know what the line is?
No, I don't know. Bruce does all this research.
Well, I just read a few articles. I read the Life magazine. Actually, I read there's a Life magazine article you can get online from 1948. We'll show you the page later. But your longest line in the movie, they kept the line short so they could do these quick takes. Do you know what the line was?
No, I have
no idea.
Because
I wanted you to do it with the accent. But it's funny, Julie, working at the embassy, and all the time she was your niece. That's your longest line in the movie. Reed also had some... Take this off, Raymond. Get ready for the next clip. Reed also had some tricks to make you react in certain ways. And we're going to show you... We're going to take a look at a scene from early in the movie. Let's take a look at this scene. Ready? Okay. Picture, okay. Now, in that scene, you're not really, in that shot, you're not really looking at Ralph Richardson.
Well, you're in a studio. I mean, one of the things I loved. People ask me. Bruce doesn't want me to say this, but I'm going to say it. People ask me, what was it like? Because you had all these famous people, Ralph Richardson, Michelle Morgan, she must have looked gorgeous, and all this kind of thing. They say, what was it like? And what it was like for me is that I loved being on this set, on this studio set, where everything was made of plywood, where everything was painted, where that terrific marble staircase is in fact linoleum. And I loved that. I joked the other day, I was sort of asked this question. I said that it had, the place had a smell of plywood. You know, it smelled like Home Depot. You know that smell. I loved that. But it's a studio. And in fact, there was the upstairs and the downstairs. There was the basement. Okay, this was pre-upstairs, downstairs stuff, but it was already there. And there was the upstairs with the marble staircase and so on. But it was a studio, okay? And so that scene obviously is shot quite differently. There I am looking over the banisters, and Ralph Richardson is playing downstairs. But that's done separately. This is movie making, you know. That's not the way it is. And so apparently the legend, and I think it's a legend, but it's a good one, is that I was very serious, and you couldn't just ask me, it was like a cat, you couldn't just ask me to do things, you couldn't ask me to smile if I didn't feel like smiling. So I was told to smile, but I didn't particularly feel like smiling. So the legend was that Carol Reed, no expense spared, this wonderful producer, he brought a magician in doing his tricks in order to get me to smile for that scene.
I believe it.
Well, he believes it.
No, it looks like you're looking at a magician.
he believes it. We had a discussion about this the other day. You know, memory. These things happen to you when you're a kid. You have a memory. Is it something that people told you? Is it something that you think that you remember? I do think it actually happened. But it's sort of what I call, cynically, part of the Carol Reed legend.
That's fine with me. Okay, next one.
I'm happy about that.
Print the legend. Okay, this is Guy Hamilton, the assistant director, who you don't actually remember from the time, but he was very vocal about you in later years.
Yes, Guy Hamilton, a very famous guy, because he went on, and he was he directed, I think, was it three or four of the James
Bond.
Well,
the most famous one, Goldfinger, he directed.
Yeah, three or four of the James Bond films. So he went on.
May I also add that he also was the assistant on third man, and he doubled for Orson Welles in the sewer.
That's right. But he obviously didn't like me because he had the job of being Carol Reed's assistant. And I guess he had to sort of step in when things would get out of control. And I think he described me as
an odd little kid with an effeminate accent.
With a foreign accent.
Something like that. His accent wasn't so great either.
He didn't like having to deal with this little kid. And I think it sort of got worse because when the movie came out, and it was a very successful movie, back in 1948, very successful. And, you know, when it first comes out, they're featuring these famous actors, so Ralph Richardson, he'd already been knighted, you know, he very famous at that point. He'd acted with John Gielgud and Laurence Olivier, and then Michel Morgan, who was also very, very well known at the time. So the movie comes out featuring all these great actors, and Carol Reed and Graham Greene and so on. But the critics loved it, and of course, the angle of the critics was the little kid, and so as the movie gets more and more successful, and as they promote it, the PR people promote more and more the role of the kid, and I think that didn't particularly please all these adults.
Ralph
Richardson. The kid kind of steals the show. He's clueless, but he steals the show, and so I think my view of Guy Hamilton is that, you know, he's
I read that Richardson was heard saying in his dressing room, "Next quarter will have me opposite a dog."
That's right.
Next slide, please. Oh, by the way, Guy Hamilton just died a month ago.
And then I get asked, you know, is anybody left alive on this film? One of the odd things, you know, here I am sitting with you and with my friend Bruce here. This thing happened, 68 years ago. So I feel like I'm on an escalator, you know, I'm the next to fall off, you know, which is true. I'm 77, you know, I'm looking around. I hope it won't be too painful when I fall off the escalator. But there is one other person living, Michel Morgan.
Who's 96.
Was born in 1920, and she's 96. She's just ahead of me on the escalator.
She was also in the trailer you saw for Port of Shadows at the age of 18. Beautiful performance.
Yeah.
And that's you having your hair done. There's a great hair story, the hair incident.
Which is part of the legend.
Another legend.
Right.
It's a good one.
Well, as you know, in movie making, there's the idea of continuity, because movie making, by its very nature, scenes are split, and very often scenes are not necessarily shot in chronological order. So continuity is extremely important in movie making. So there's this legend, which is true, but I think it's a legend, that there's this scene in the movie where I'm going from the bottom of the staircase to the top of the staircase or something, and I begin at the bottom, and the scene is shot on a Friday, and then the scene where I'm higher up on the staircase is going to be shot on Monday. And during the weekend, my mother decides to cut my hair. So continuity. And so, the PR, Bruce, PR people.
But I can imagine that.
You're in the PR business.
Yeah, well,
you understand this thing. So they
can
cut the most expensive haircut in history, you know.
Carol Reed actually lost his temper. Rare.
Right.
Really?
And then blame my mother. And that was excellent. They were right to do that.
Okay. Next slide. Well, here you are looking into the camera. You were fascinated by the technical end. Right? I guess that's Richardson on the left and Carol Reed on the right. Oh, the second from the right is Carol Reed now. I don't know who those chaps are. Okay, next one. Okay, here's the Life magazine article. A staggering performance. Guy Hamilton and Ralph.
Guy Hamilton must have loved this, yes.
I love the way this article opens. It says, quote, "London film critics were caught off their surly guard this fall by a small boy with an uneven walk, a misbegotten haircut, and an odd foreign accent."
That's right.
The article also said that you had a very sweet nature. In real life.
Yeah, we're in real life. Yeah.
Okay. Next slide, Raymond. And here is, this is from the Life article. These are pictures of Carol Reed showing you what to do. Next. And next. And next, here's an ad where you have bigger billing than Michelle Morgan and Ralph Richardson.
Yeah, they love that.
And I mean, love the little cutout of all these tributes to you. Sir Ralph and the Child Wonder. Boy Star was not let into the plot. Bobby didn't know he was a star. Greatest kid since Coogan. I like that.
This is PR. I mean, this is to sell this stuff. That's it.
And I have one more. Here's your mother and you. Next one, Raymond, at the premiere, which was a Royal Command performance.
That's right.
Do you remember that evening?
Yeah, well, I do. And I think there's a picture, I don't think you have it there, where I was chosen. This is a great honor. I was chosen to give the Queen a bouquet.
Queen, the current Queen's mother.
Exactly.
The Queen Mum.
And I eventually wrote a book about this experience as I look back on what had happened to me as a little kid. And one of the amazing things about the world that we live in today is that you can go to places like YouTube. And I found
The newsreel is on YouTube.
The
newsreel of you giving
The newsreel of that Royal Command performance is on YouTube, and the comment on YouTube is that Ronald Reagan was in the room, and of course I had no idea who Ronald Reagan was at the time. I wouldn't even have known that he was in the room. But again, one of the fun things was looking back on the whole Fallen Idol, how would it affected my life, and to find out that at that particular time, at that particular performance, Ronald Reagan was in the room. I mean, I thought that was...
We're thrilled by that, yes.
Yeah.
Let's take some questions from the audience. Wait for the microphone down here.
Just out of interest, which month in 1939 were you born?
What was I born? Which month?
Which month?
June 26th.
Oh, I was born in February.
Okay. All right.
You've got a few months on him.
Okay. Yeah.
But not in Normandy, I take it.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, your mother looks radiant and really thrilled by this, but she had some fame of her own later on as a writer, correct?
Yes. My mother, who was born in France, became quite a successful writer. Actually, my parents were in sort of partnership. My father was a journalist, very fine craftsman when it came to writing, but my mother was a great storyteller. And she, in England in the 50s and earlys, and in the 50s, she became quite famous writing books about her childhood in France.
And I noticed today that a lot of them are available on Google Books.
There you are, Google Books.
I know today also.
Yeah.
Another question from the audience. Over here, middle of this fourth row. No, where are you going? Okay. We only have one.
Give you a snake to play with?
Did they really give you a snake to play with?
Oh yeah, it was a real snake, and I get that whenever I'm in this kind of setting, I get asked that question. It was a totally harmless grass snake, and it wasn't particularly scary to me. You know, I'd had the experience of living on a farm in France, and I was sort of used to animals. You were told this is a fine animal; it was okay. But the snake was very important. People loved the snake in the film. And I think, you know, it had to do with the sort of Graham Greene hang up with Original Sin and all that kind of stuff, you know. Graham Greene was a tortured guy, which I think made him, you know, very, very interesting. And so later on in life, when I look back at this whole thing, I saw the snake as being part of Graham Greene's religious hang-ups. He had lots of them.
Not
the snakes, the hang-ups.
I want to quote the Life magazine article one more time. It says, when asked how to sob heartbrokenly over the death of a pet snake, Bobby exploded with brief indignation. Quote, well, he, meaning Carol Reed, showed me what's the producer for. Next question from the audience, also in this row. And then go in the back.
What was it like to go back to normal life after this?
the question is, what was it like going back to normal life? That's a terrific question. It was difficult because, and I mean, this is serious stuff, the movie was very successful. I had had a very odd childhood. I was an only child. All my contacts had been with adults. My parents were journalists. It was an abnormal childhood. You can't help being conscious of success and fame, and it's a drug. It pushes you up there, and to get back to some sense of normalcy, you have to come off that, and it is painful. And it was particularly painful for me because my parents wanted me to be brought up in this British system where they send you off to a boarding school. I mean, this is back in the early 50s. And so, I was told suddenly, you've got to go away and go to one of these British boarding schools. And it was miserable in the sense that, I felt like a fish out of water. Kids are rough on each other. We all know that. And I was teased. Kids don't like...
teased because of their fame.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was sort of a, odd person out, and I was, it was unpleasant. So it took me a long time to sort of get back to normal. And in fact, when I went back and wrote about how this has affected my life, I dealt with it through denial, through trying to pretend that it had never happened to me. And I didn't like talking about it. And I actually didn't like talking about it for most of my life until finally I decided I'm going to look back on this thing and I'm going to come to terms with the fact that there was some very bright, interesting people. It was a great story. It was something that I could now be, in my old age, I could now be proud of having been part of, but it took me a very, very long time to get back to that. So that's a sort of searching question. And I wrote the book as a therapy to deal with that.
What memories do you have of Ralph Richardson and Michelle Morgan, if any?
I mentioned sort of humor earlier on that what I was really interested in was the set, the carpenters, the way this set had been built up, because that was a make-believe world that I could sort of relate to as a little kid. The people themselves, these great actors, were pretty distant, I kind of, again, joke about that a little bit. It was a job. I mean, you showed up at the studio at whatever time it was, 9 o'clock, 9:30. You worked through the day. It was sort of like a 9-to-5 job. And everybody else there was doing a job. I mean, including these great people like Ralph Richardson, who was concerned about what he was going to act in next, who was concerned about their auditions for their next gig. And so they were somewhat distant, I was this little kid, and I was just part of the team, and that was it.
Ralph did give you a birthday present, though, didn't he?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, that's something.
Yeah, I'm sure I was.
But you had one friend, the most unlikely best friend of the cast.
The nicest person, and that's the nicest person to me who sort of paid attention to me as a little kid, was the Queen of the Night, Sonia Dresdell, who is the
wife.
Who is the
Mrs.
wife.
Mrs. Baines.
And she was a real sweetie. I really have a wonderful memory of her. So there you are. But it's a movie. It's make-believe. So there you are. She was a good actress.
And it has such a wonderful cast. Some of these people became stars later on, like Jack Hawkins,
yes, Jack
10
Hawkins,
years later.
Absolutely. Bridge Over the River Kwai.
10 years later, yeah.
Absolutely.
Bernard Lee, who later played M, the one who thinks he can speak French. He later became M in all the James Bond movies. There was Dennis O'Day, the quiet detective,
right.
The great
right.
Irish actor.
Yeah.
He was married to Chauvin.
Yes.
McKenna, and who else? Dora Bryan.
And Dora Bryan.
Well,
she was a sweetie, and I met her later on in life. She was great.
I remember she was in. Remember, she was in later on, Taste of Honey with Rita Tushing and Tony Richardson.
Exactly, and she did character parts. She was terrific.
That line, I know. Oh, I know your daddy.
Oh, I know your daddy.
I feel that she ad libbed that. It's very not Graham Greene. I know that he didn't write that.
You think she added it in?
Well, she used to ad lib a lot.
Maybe Carol Reed sneaked it in. You know,
it's kind of a cheap laugh, but it's great anyway.
Oh, I know your daddy.
Any other questions from the audience? Let's go back in the middle of the auditorium. Where's our... Okay.
Hi. First, let me say it's one of my favorite films, and I was here like 10 years ago when you appeared, and it's great to see this again. And I think I asked this question then, and you didn't know the answer. I'm hoping maybe you know. Now, I always wanted to know if you knew how they did the trick with the airplane, the paper airplane, because of how it just perfectly does the semicircles and just lands right at his feet.
That's a great question. How did they get that little
Nowadays it would be CGI.
I don't know the answer to that, but it's very impressive the way it circles around. Yeah. Terrific question. I don't know. All I can tell you is I was certainly not the one who flew it. That I can tell you. Maybe it was, you know, Carol Reed, the magician. Maybe he flew it.
So you were this hot item for a while. Court assigned you to a contract. Didn't court assign you to a contract after the movie?
Yes. You know, basically the movie was a great success. My parents were completely taken aback by the whole experience. Korda was concerned that somebody else would come in, and he was at that point concerned with the third man. But he was concerned, so he got my parents to sign a contract that I would basically not act for any other film company. And they did put together a movie called The Wonder
Kid. It has two titles.
The Wonder Kid. It was a pretty awful movie. Well, it was a child prodigy, musician. It was based in Austria. Bruce will tell us.
Well, I hope you don't mind because I have a clip from it.
No, I don't mind.
Are you ready, Raymond, with the clip?
It's pretty awful.
You're about 9 or 10 now. Right?
I was about 10 by then. Yeah, yeah.
Where's Miss Crispy?
Oh, your mother?
I haven't seen your mother. Miss Crispy's my governess.
Yeah?
Where is she?
She ran out.
Pardon?
She beat it. How?
Why?
Oh, I know. She's not here.
Last night she took me away in the middle of the concert. She seemed very excited. We got in the car, and then I fell asleep. But I don't understand what I'm doing here. Do you?
Why don't you eat your breakfast?
Are you a detective?
Me? Are you kidding?
What's the name of this? A gangster?
The director, Carl Hartle, obviously no Carol Reed.
No, nor was the screenwriter Graham Greene.
No
Carol Reed. Okay. Yeah.
So that was the end of your movie career.
That was Cup the end of my movie. That was it.
And then you've had a very complicated relationship with your early fame. You wanted to let it go completely. You stopped being Bobby for one thing.
Absolutely. And yes.
To this day, you're right. Robert. Always right. Not even Bob.
Absolutely. Even after
you moved to America, you're still not Bob.
Yeah,
okay.
No, yeah. So, and I escaped, you know, I tried to escape from this thing.
But then
which is probably why I came to New York, you know, trying to escape from it.
We got
to
do the rest of your life in the Reader's Digest version. You went to Oxford.
Yeah, I went to Oxford.
You met your wife there.
Which I loved because I felt that was the one thing you know, that was a time when Carol Reed wasn't there telling me what to do. That was a great.
And you met your wife there.
I met my wife.
You're married.
There.
You moved to the U.S.
over 50 years ago, and I became an accountant.
Unlikely for an accountant.
Well, yeah, but you know, I had to do something, so I became an accountant.
But I have a theory of why you became. Because of part of your ancestry. You're related on your father's side to the Rothschilds.
Yes, sort of like numbers.
So there's a little bit of Jewish in you, too.
That's right.
That's good.
That's right.
But you grew up Protestant.
It's true. So, my wife and I got married. We came to New York City 51 years ago.
But your religious history is pretty interesting because you're descended from the Rothschilds. Your paternal grandfather was an Anglican priest.
That's right.
Your French grandmother was a French Protestant.
That's right.
But you became a Catholic.
I became a Catholic.
On your own.
Because of the snake.
Not because of Graham Greene proselytizing. No. He also became a Catholic later on in life, right?
Yeah.
And after you retired from, you were a partner in a big firm.
Yes, I was, an accounting firm.
What was it called?
Well, it was Coopers & Lybrand Price, PwC.
Okay.
Yeah.
You made another big decision in life.
Well, I had been ordained a deacon, a Catholic deacon, and I get asked, well, why did I do that? I think for me it was a feeling of trying to set aside some time in my life to do something other than just pursue a very aggressive professional career, you know, particularly in New York City. And I did that. And then when I retired, I had a chance to work as a chaplain in the local hospital. And I did that for about 12 years after my retirement. And it was a great opportunity. I joke with my friends, I had three careers. I was a movie star. I was a CPA. And then I ended up working.
I have a picture of you in your vestments. Let's see the next one. You know, we had Mother Dolores Hart here a month. Yeah. We're becoming Vatican III here at Film Forum.
Yeah, that was my third job.
Yeah. And so I understand you're off to France.
Yes.
And tell the audience where you're going on France.
Yeah.
Where are you going on Monday?
Well, I'm going to this place I was born in 1939.
Let's see a picture of it.
And Bruce is going to show you a picture of it. This was actually taken at the time of my birth, but it still, and I'm going there on Monday, it still very much looks like that, and I'm very lucky to have been able to hold on to it. And it's a place where I, you know, feel very much rooted.
So you
it's
have
great
a
to be able to go back to it.
You have a fantastic continuity in your life.
That's right, continuity.
It's great. And he's written this incredible memoir, which is not available in this country yet, except we have it here tonight. It's called Through Grown Up Eyes.
The idea is that you get to a certain point in maturity and you need to sort of heal all the stuff that happens to you in life and you look back. I mean, the movie is looking at these adults through the eyes of a child, and I got to a point where I said, well, now I can look at this whole thing through grown-up eyes.
And you've inherited your mother's talent for storytelling.
Oh,
it's
nice
fantastic.
Of you. Nice of you to
and
say
it's
that.
A lot about Fallen Idol, but the rest of your life as well. Well, I really recommend it. Thanks again. By the way, can we call you?
Thank you.
I want to call you Bobby just this one more time. Thank you, Bobby Henry. He's still cute, isn't he?
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.